Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
Hello, you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald.
Coming up, it's been over 100 days since Donald Trump was inaugurated as president for the second time. We'll be reflecting on his presidency so far and what might happen next, including how US-Canada relations may pan out following the victory of Mark Carney.
Also, the Irish band Kneecap have apologised to the families of Sir David Amess and Joe Cox after footage emerged of them saying, "Kill your local MP." We'll be discussing whether violence against MPs is becoming more normalised and what repercussions this might have for the safety of our politicians.
As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media. All that and more coming up later in the programme.
But first, it's The Week Unwrapped.
So what we want to see on Thursday is as many Conservative councillors winning as possible. That is all I'm talking about at the moment. I know it's going to be challenging, but people will have to live with what is elected after that. How do we make sure that we show that we are the best party on offer? And that's something that all of my colleagues agree with me on.
Just to be really clear, you have ruled out any sort of deal with reform at a national level. Just to be really clear, hypothetically, after a general election, if it meant being able to govern, if the Conservatives and Reform had the most number of seats, you might do it.
Right. But Beth, I can't say this any more than I've already said. I've been saying this literally every day for months. I am not going into coalition with Nigel Farage. I don't know how much clearer I can be.
Voting is underway in local elections across England, with over 1,600 seats being contested in 23 councils, and six mayoral positions are also up for grabs. This will be the first electoral test for the party leaders since last year's general election, which saw a Labour landslide. And of course, there's also the by-election taking place in Runcorn and Helsby, after Labour MP Mike Amesbury stood down following his conviction for punching a man, a constituent, in the street. Nigel Farage has downplayed Reform's chances at victory in Runcorn. However, a win would provide hard evidence of voters in traditional Labour constituents being swayed by his party. And of course, we're likely to see Labour shifting rightward if such a thing were to happen. Ali, what do you think we need to look out for when the polls close at 10 p.m. tonight? I mean, we're not going to get a raft of results in straight away like we do with the general election. Mm-hmm. But there, what sort of things are you going to be looking for the next 24 or 48 hours?
I think first is you're not going to get an exit poll like you do in the mm-hmm. general election. So if you're staying up, if you think you're going to get a result at 10 p.m, you're going to be disappointed. I think what I'll be looking for specifically is Labour to Reform switch, because these set of local elections, they're not happening everywhere. So they're happening more prominently in Tory seats. Mm. So the actual bleeding for Labour is pretty limited in regards to the damage that could be done compared to the 2021 polls. So what will be really interesting, as well as seeing where Labour sits as a proportion of the vote compared to 2021, is to also see the swings, whether people are swinging away from Labour to the Conservatives, to the Liberals, to the Greens, or even to Reform, and the political impacts that might come there. Like you said, there's a lot of people worried that Labour's going to swing further to the right. I don't know if there's much room left to the right of Labour, but we'll see. So I think there's a couple of things that are interesting for people to watch out for. First, this is the first time Kemi Badenoch goes to the poll, so let's see how people react to her. Let's see if there's a Reform Conservative split like there was in 2024. Just so everyone's aware, in 2021, the Conservatives got 41% of the vote out of those local seats. Labour got 36, the Liberals got 7, Reform didn't really exist at the time, and Greens got 5%, although the Reform of the time got 2%, I think, or the party that we would consider closest to Reform got 2%. So the Conservatives and Labour kind of dominated the top two spaces. The question is, are we now going to enter into a more multipolar party system? And then there's Runcorn, which is the by-election that's taking place in Runcorn and Helsby, which interestingly enough is one of Labour's safest seats in the entire country. So I expect Labour to just about hold on there because it is such a safe Labour seat that you would expect Labour to hold on. If Reform win that, then Nigel Farage will be completely buoyant, and it will be a signal, I think, to Westminster that Reform are serious, serious players, mm-hmm. and should be Labour circles should certainly be worried about Farage's party. What are you looking out for?
Yeah, I think that all sounds about right to me. I think what's going to be really interesting is, as much as we've heard about the swing of support towards Reform, we haven't actually seen how a tactical stop Reform vote could materialise, especially in that area of Runcorn. You know, are people going to come out in their numbers, even if they're disappointed with Labour, disappointed with the Conservatives, would they still come out to try and keep Reform out by voting Labour? That would be an interesting question.
Have you seen Labour's, some of their material, particularly online? It's all stop Farage.
Is it? Yeah.
Yeah, it's all stop Farage. It's not even bothered about the Tories.
Yeah. And I think the mayoralties are going to be interesting. You know, it's quite possible we could get our first Reform mayor in Andrew Jenkins in Lincolnshire, which could be extraordinary, and I'd be very interested to see, since her whole proposal is creating the Lincolnshire version of Doge, how Lincolnshire is going to how Lincolnshire is going to function without any money. But you know, if that's what the constituents, if that's what the good people of Lincolnshire want, then you know, but better them than us.
Let me ask you a question, because on that Doge, I saw something online. It's kind of relevant to this, but I saw something online that talked about how both the right and left of British politics seem a little bit obsessed with America and are copying the language and the messaging. And essentially the right wants to be Trump and the left wants to be AOC. And that's not the culture here. Do you think that's true?
I don't know about the left wanting to be AOC. I mean, who specifically are we talking about?
I think a lot of that was around things like the Green New Deal. Because the New Deal is an American term of the economic New Deal.
So I know that Labour did do quite a lot of looking at Bidenomics and kind of thinking how they could incorporate that, because at the time when they were designing their manifesto or their policies for next general election, it seemed like the economy was improving in America and obviously everyone would vote for Biden again. But I think you're right that people are, you know, wanting to copy Trumpian stuff on the right.
What about the right?
Yeah,
because Trump is not actually, like you've mentioned multiple times, the polls suggest Trump is not very popular in the UK.
No, he's not.
But the right seem to want to be the Trumpy. Everyone's trying to be Trump. Right?
I think it's because they see him as an example of success so they want to emulate it. But, you know, a lot of it is social media as well. These ideas spread very, very quickly and they sort of catch on. I mean, a lot of Kemi Badenoch's culture warring and the stuff she throws at Keir Starmer seems to be directly lifted from X.
Yeah.
You can see how those ideas get thrown around.
She seems to be the most chronically online party leader I've ever seen.
And she doesn't actually do the research to see if any of the things she's basing her attacks on.
I think she's the first major political leader I've seen that seems politically and ideologically attached to her phone.
Yes.
Like, much of her messaging and beliefs and views are what I would expect to see on the dark parts
of
Twitter.
She is, if a keyboard warrior became a politician.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, let's move on. So Ukraine and the US have now signed a much-anticipated natural resources deal after months
Thanks
of
Thanks to President Trump's tireless efforts to secure a lasting peace, I am glad to announce the signing of today's historic economic partnership agreement between the United States and Ukraine, establishing the United States-Ukraine Reconstruction Investment Fund. This partnership allows the United States to invest alongside Ukraine to unlock Ukraine's growth assets, mobilize American talent, capital, and governance standards that will improve Ukraine's investment climate and accelerate Ukraine's economic recovery. The Development Finance Corporation will participate and help to establish this fund in collaboration with the government of Ukraine.
The deal, which says the US will share profits from future sales of Ukraine's mineral and energy reserves, aims to incentivize Washington to invest further in Ukraine's defense and reconstruction. The initial deal fell apart in February after the famous heated clash between Trump and Zelensky in the Oval Office, where Trump accused Zelensky of gambling with World War III. However, the two were seen in deep discussion on Saturday at the funeral of the Pope Francis. Ali, what do you make of this? Is this a step in the right direction? Are we going to finally see some peace between Ukraine and Russia on the back of this?
Doesn't look like it, but in terms of Ukraine and Russia, that seems... then there doesn't seem to be much momentum behind negotiations. And you can tell that there isn't, based on some of Trump's rhetoric. He seems to be getting quite frustrated with it. Let's not forget, Trump said that he would end this war when he was campaigning in office, and he's now talking about possibly stepping away. There's a couple of things in this deal that I think are actually quite important. One is that there's no requirement for the Ukrainians to pay back the around $350 billion of aid that was provided to Ukraine during the war. Mm. Previously, it's something that Trump has had called a debt and a condition that Zelensky had rejected previously. So there was a view that, that the aid that had been provided was more of a loan, which the Ukrainian side had rejected. It seems that Trump and the American side have conceded on that. Because it's not part of the deal for that to be paid back. So that's a major win, I think, for the Ukrainian side, although Trump, as always, has presented it, the whole deal as a win for the Americans. You have also seen in the last few days a tougher stance and more a tougher rhetoric between from the United States on Putin and Russia, particularly. I think we had some airstrikes in Kyiv that pulled some particularly harsh tones out of Trump. But this oil and gas and minerals deal was supposed to be signed, like you said, with that famous meeting in the White House that was cut short. And I know this time, I don't think Zelensky went to sign the agreement. They sent, was it the Prime Minister? Who did they send? But it certainly wasn't Zelensky to sign the deal. So if anyone thought that Trump would be able to end this sort of quagmire early, I think they're going to be disappointed. It looks like it's a long road towards a ceasefire. Although Putin did announce a 3-day Russian ceasefire for Ukraine on the 8th of May as well, to coincide with the Second World War.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. And do you think, I mean, does it look like, because for a while it looked like Trump was really going pretty pro-Russia in his rhetoric. It looks like in the past couple of weeks or so, especially since Pope Francis' funeral, that he's publicly, at least, he seems to be more supportive of Zelensky in Ukraine.
Yeah.
I mean, should we be hopeful on that? Do you think his tougher tone is towards Putin is got some longevity behind it? Or do you think, you know, my opinion is this man just smiles at the last person he was in the room with, you know, and actually sees it all as just a bit of a game and a schmooze.
Yeah, so the thing that worries me, the thing that I think we should keep an eye on with Trump is that he needs a foreign policy win, and he hasn't had one. Because when he came into office, he spoke about three key things. He spoke about Gaza and Israel, he spoke about Russia and Ukraine, and he spoke about Iran's nuclear deal. Now, in Gaza and Israel, he's not been able to accomplish anything. No. He had this big Gaza plan that disappeared. The ceasefire disappeared. They can't get aid into Gaza. Russia, Ukraine, he said he would end that war, and that looks further away than it ever has, I think, in his presidency. And the Iran nuclear deal, that's where they've made the most progress. So I think he needs a key win in one of these three areas. And it looks like it might not come from Russia. So I think the harsher tone you're seeing isn't actually political, ideological. It has nothing to do with peace. It's Trump caring about only one person, and that's Trump, and not getting the foreign policy win he wants is what's drawing the ire.
Okay. The government has defended its net zero policies after Sir Tony Blair said limiting fossil fuels was doomed to fail and a new approach was needed. The former Prime Minister argued that the climate change debate had become irrational and people in rich countries no longer wanted to make financial sacrifices when they know that their impact on global emissions is minimal. However, minutes before PMQs, the Tony Blair Institute issued a statement saying they support the government's 2050 net zero targets and that their approach is the right one. While Labour ministers have insisted the drive to net zero will not involve any financial sacrifices and have minimal impact on people's lives. Ali, say Labour has a load of losses in the locals this week. Is Ed Miliband on the chopping board? Because it feels like there's some pretty... I mean, this is, you know, Tony Blair Institute, but a lot of this rhetoric around net zero is ramping up, and it feels like there's some nozzles pointed at Ed Miliband here and his green policies.
Yeah, so I think Ed has been on the chopping board for a little while, and I certainly expect a reshuffle to come after the locals sometime in the summer. I think it'll probably be June that we'll get a reshuffle. And Ed, I would put Ed in the camp of at risk of being reshuffled out, because the noise didn't just start with this, but have been permeating since the election. And we've already seen Labour water down its green policy. If you remember the £28 billion of investment that disappeared and were watered down. Now we have this intervention from Tony Blair, who I think with the best will in the world, most people in Labour would wish to just go away.
Why doesn't he just go away?
You know what? He's turning into the Labour equivalent of that uncle who was really, really left-wing in the 60s and was a hippie, but now has turned into like this old right-wing man who rants at dinner about how things have changed and why all these millennial, why they just want to eat their avocado and toast and everybody wishes he would leave and stop talking. That's what Tony Blair is in the Labour Party now. He's that uncle that everybody else wishes would stop talking and go away.
So I read bits of the report in question, and I have to say some of this is a bit of mischief making from the right-wing papers. So the Telegraph and the Times reporting, or, you know, even Tony Blair thinks net zero is going to fail. Yeah. I mean, Labour, you know, what chance does Labour have? Well, it's not really quite what it said. Yes, there was a lot of quite heavy criticism of the government's strategy in there. But they did say they were committed to net zero targets. Yeah. And they did say that it was a matter of adopting technology. Now, I'm not defending Tony Blair, because my point is, I mean, what stupid timing. You know, days before local elections, when you know that Labour's progressive policies are being weaponized against them by parties like Reform, why would you give the right-wing papers fodder to attack your former party?
Well, look, Tony doesn't do anything by mistake. He's an astute political operator. He knows that Labour's going to get a kicking at the local elections, and he knows that that might be a trigger for a reshuffle, and he wants Ed out. That's clearly the noise. That's clearly the strategy behind what's going on here. And Tony Blair, as we know, if anyone smells of an inch to the left of centre, he wants them gone. And Ed Miliband is probably the last sort of, centre-left in the cabinet.
Well, you've got Rayner, you've got Nandy, but they've been a bit quiet as of late.
Nandy's nowhere near on the left of the party. But Rayner,
she was soft-left.
Yeah, but Rayner, I think once. Yeah.
Once upon a time. Yeah.
What did David Cameron say? I was the future once. Rayner definitely is, but he can't get rid of Rayner because she holds an elected position. Mm. His actual quote was, "Any strategy based on either phasing out fossil fuels in the short term or limited consumption is a strategy doomed to fail." The problem with that is, what's the alternative to Tony's proposing? That we just tank it in and throw in the towel on green investment and ending our reliance on fossil fuel? I mean, bear in mind, Tony Blair and the Tony Blair Institute have been linked, allegedly, to Saudi Arabia and big oil nations and doing consultancy work and stuff like that. So there's, you know, I don't think we should take his view as an objective, unconnected sort of...
This is the argument I keep having with people about net zero, which is that they say, you know, renewables are very expensive, people's bills are going to go up, we can't afford it. To which the argument is, if we don't do it now, what do you think it's going to cost us in 20 years' time when we don't have those oil and gas reserves to draw on anymore, when we haven't invested in renewables and every other country has, and therefore we are not ahead, no one wants to invest in us, our infrastructure's too old, too aged, everything's... Have we not learned anything from HS2? Like, you have to invest, you have to be long-termist about it, you can't just be short-termist. And maybe the politicians do need to be a bit more honest about the cost to consumers, but actually, the real reason that energy prices in this country are so high is because of our dependent on foreign oil and gas markets. Mm-hmm. Oil and gas sets the price of energy in this country. And even if you don't think there is a moral or ethical argument for renewables, or if you don't think there is a economic argument for renewables, you have to admit that there is a security argument for it. Yeah. Because we are at the moment dependent, or we were dependent on Russia. That's no good. Yeah. That's no good for our security and resilience.
Yeah,
so,
you know, I once had a professor say to me, when you talk about the costs of renewables, try counting your money while holding your breath. That's the choice. That's I think there's been a lot of conversations around the cost of these things and whether we can afford them or not. Well, let's look at when it came down to military dependence and military spending, when what happened in Russia sort of triggered the government to go, no, we do need to go up to 2.5%. And most people agreed that we needed our own independence as it pertains to security. Mm-hmm. well, what we're talking about here isn't a social construct. It's literally the habitability of our planet.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Okay, coming up, Donald Trump has been president for over 100 days. And what a whirlwind it has been. Well, we're going to be reflecting on Trump's first months in the Oval Office and how the rest of the year may pan out for the president in his second term. We'll discuss that next on Politics Uncensored.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on FUBAR Radio.
Death, a funny business on FUBAR Radio with Becky Briggs and Natasha Spencer-Levy.
The lovely Matt Phipps.
Hello.
The thing that surprised me most was how much joy I took in being, like, making people feel really uncomfortable.
It's so
Amen.
Good. So good.
Your mum jokes change completely.
My friend the other day, she was like, how tall is your mum? And I was like, oh, she's 6 feet under. Yeah, they did not know what to do with that. Yeah. And then you let it hang in the air.
Yeah.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores. Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
It's the sound of your mates alive. It's getting to more gigs this year and the next. It's the sound of saying, I got you, mate. It's the sound of mates enjoying even more of this. It's the sound of mates getting home instead of here. Click your seatbelt, because you're twice as likely to be killed or seriously injured if you don't think.
When you notice something wrong, it tends to grow and eventually take over, to the point you can't really think of anything else. If something in your body doesn't feel right, the thought it could be cancer can play on your mind. Tests could put your mind at rest. Finding out sooner is always better. Your NHS wants to see you. Contact your GP practice.
Pulse of the Nation with Andrew White on FUBAR Radio.
Danny Harmer, hello.
Thank you, what an introduction.
I heard in an interview, this may no longer be the case, but in 2020 you said you'd never actually read the original Tracy Beaker.
I've still never read it, and I'm gonna go down with this ship, and quite frankly, I shall never read it. I've got this far in life. And do you know what? I think it's kind of, in a weird way, I think it helped me get the part, because I had no idea of this character apart from the character that I made her.
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
You might then see friends, family that require a little bit of support, financial advice. How do you go about sharing that advice, sharing that support without being condescending?
A practical tip that everyone can do that is low friction: send them financial content that you like. If you have a favorite content creator, if you see an article that you like, send them the video and just ask them, what do you think? And then that can begin a conversation around it.
At Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald. Now, it's been over 100 days since Donald Trump was sworn into office for the second time.
In 100 days, we have delivered the most profound change in Washington in nearly 100 years. I read an editorial today that this is the most consequential presidency in history. How about that? And it wasn't even by a group that would normally be supporting us. It was a group of people that I think they tend to be on the liberal side, but they said it's the most important election, the November 5th, it changed it all. You have to see, well, you hear some of these numbers, but that is the most consequential election that we've ever had in our country. And what a nice thing. I'm going to start again subscribing to that particular paper. Even if I don't read it much, I'm going to subscribe. But it was a very nice compliment, especially from them. They know who I'm talking about. We're ushering out the long reign of special interests and the radical left lunatics, and we're ushering in the golden age of America. That's what we have.
Do you think Donald Trump knows that consequential doesn't necessarily mean good?
I think the key part of that was, I don't read.
Yeah, yeah. well, okay, what 100 days it has been. Here are just some of the highlights you may have missed. Trump has signed 142 executive orders, including freezing foreign aid, banning transgender troops from the military service, and starting the withdrawal process of the US from the World Health Organization. He pardoned more than 1,500 people, including supporters convicted in connection with the US Capitol riot in 2021, many of whom had other convictions as well. His administration also implemented a flurry of tariffs. Do you remember them? They sent shockwaves through the markets and almost led to a global recession. They probably tanked your parents' pension as well. Trump has visited 11 global leaders, including a very tense meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Oh, and remember Elon Musk? Well, he had a government department created for him called the Department of Government Efficiency, a.k.a. DOGE. Ali, any highlights that you'd care to mention?
Yeah, let's think about 100 days of Trump, which feel like 100 years under Donald Trump. The Trump administration has been deporting people left, right and center, including illegally, with the most famous case of a man being deported to El Salvador. He boasted about the economy. Remember that? He said after he was elected, he said that the stock market was as a result of the hope and buoyancy of a Donald Trump presidency come in. Well, where are we now? The S&P 500 down 3.3%, NASDAQ down 4.5%, the Dow Jones down 5.3%. And since Inauguration Day, the markets have fallen even further. S&P since Inauguration down 7.9%, NASDAQ down 12.1%. And for the first time in years, the U.S. economy has shrunk in month to month. And yet he said this was Biden's stock market now. And while he was boasting about it a few months ago, or about a year ago, he is now boasting about the fact that this is a Biden stock market. Foreign policy, like we mentioned before, where are the wins? Nothing in Gaza and Israel, nothing in Russia and Ukraine, nothing so far with the Iran deal, although the negotiation of that are continuing. And then there's Elon Musk and Doge, in which they accidentally cut funding for Ebola responses and tackling Ebola, I think particularly in Africa, that they had to U-turn. And now even Elon Musk is having to go back to Tesla because their stocks are tanking. Mm-hmm. So it's been an amazing time. And this is the great American age, the golden age of America under Donald Trump.
Well, I noticed the sarcastic tone in your voice, and I actually do have a highlight.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah. How about Mark Carney's election? Yes. Arguably won on the back of Trump's threats to Canada about making it the 51st state. So as we know, the Liberals won in Canada after much concern that they weren't going to, that Canada, like other countries in the world, would shift rightwards. But seemingly the party was, or the country was brought together by anti-Trump sentiment. And now not only is this great for Canada in that they have a much more kind of progressive prime minister in place, but also it's great for us because we now have a progressive ally in North America.
Yeah, the Conservative Party leader, Pierre, I can't pronounce his name,
Poilievre.
So Pierre Poilievre was tipped to become the next prime minister of Canada pretty convincingly not long ago. And Donald Trump seems to have single-handedly not just cost him his election, but he lost his own seat.
Yes. Because he was flying back and forth, obviously, to have conversations with Trump.
Yeah, because he was seeing it quite soft on Trump until some of the 51st state stuff. And then he had to catch up to Carney in being sort of more of a defender of Canada. Mm. And voters never really, from my limited understanding, believed him. And it seems like it was political expediency, his harder lines on Trump.
Mm.
And so I think it's safe to say that Mark Carney owes his victory to the rhetoric coming out of the United States and Donald Trump. So that seems to be a highlight. I'm trying to think of what would Donald Trump say is his highlight. We'll talk about the Canada stuff in a second, but what might he say is his highlight? I guess the pardoning was stuff that he promised that he would do.
I think the deportations are the thing that, you know, I watched a little bit of Trump's speech, 100-day speech, and I think for him, it's, you know, illegal migration, as he calls it, down because of these horrendous deportations, the executive orders, which, you know, would basically prevent people from coming over to the US and having these kind of mass deportations. I think he would see that as a success, and his voters would see that as a success. But yeah, at what cost? I mean, as obviously, as you said, you know, there is huge concerns about human rights violations going on, that some people have been deported illegally or in contravention of their human rights. There now looks to be a potential standoff going on between Trump and the Supreme Court. So, you know, it might be a success optics wise for those on the right, but whether it is actually going to work, whether it's going to be lawful, is a different question.
Yeah, and I guess the tariffs are still out there. He's a big proponent of the tariffs and always has been. But I think there is a lot of anxiety both in the Republican Party and amongst Republican voters as to whether that's going to work. But there's a tremendous loyalty amongst Republican voters. The BBC did this amazing piece of they spoke to some Trump voters 100 days on, a variety of different voters from different areas of the United States. And even the ones that had been hit hard by the tariffs, people in those industries, said, yes, it's hitting us hard. Yes, we're really concerned about it, but we're going to give him the benefit of the doubt and we'll wait and see what happens. So he's got a tremendous sort of brand loyalty that he's built, which is a huge thing in politics. Should we talk about Canada?
Yeah.
Or do you want to stay on Trump?
Let's just stay on Trump for a second, because I just want to talk to you about the fact that Donald Trump's personal website has been selling Trump 2028 hats.
Have they actually?
Yes.
Right, okay.
Okay, so, you know, there is now this genuine concern that that is him laying the ground, seeding the ground to try and, in some ways, gain a third term in office, which obviously, as we know, the president can't do. There has been a suggestion that that is actually for Trump Jr.,
yeah,
who, you know, there was this suggestion, this rumor that him and Vance kind of will run on a joint ticket. And
oh, really? I hadn't heard
Trump
that,
Jr. will come into play. And then, of course, there's also the suggestion that Trump is just trying to troll and upset, you know, the wet libs or, you know, the people who just care about Constitution and rule of law and law and order. What's your take on that? What do you think he's doing there?
So, look, I don't think he can run for a third term.
No,
so,
constitutionally,
yeah,
no.
Yeah, so there is a constitutional amendment in the US Constitution. I was trying to look up what it is. I think it's 21. I'll be corrected on that, but I think it's the 21st Amendment. That says no person shall run more than twice or shall be elected more than twice. I think there's been some suggestions from the sort of Breitbart, Bannon lot that maybe that the loophole they're going to try and find is that that's consecutive. I don't think any legal scholar or constitutional scholar will uphold that. I think it is just a bit of bait. Donald Trump will be, what, 83, 84 by the time that election comes around. And he doesn't look in the best of health. So I don't think there's any way in which, A, he'll be allowed to run. Because bear in mind, even if they wanted to overturn that constitutional amendment, the way that a constitutional amendment is overturned is in the Senate by 2/3 majority. No one has a 2/3 majority. They haven't had it. No one's had a 2/3 majority in the United States Senate, I want to say, since Reagan.
Right.
I think Obama came close, but since Reagan, there's not been a 2/3 majority in the United States Senate. And so it's next to impossible to have a constitutional amendment. And these are pretty hard and fast rules. They won't let him on the ballot, for example, in certain states if this is contested. So I think it's just a...
You think it's a troll?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's hope so. I'm sure we'll find out more in due course. Let's just briefly touch on Canada then. So tell me a little bit about the election. Any kind of key takeaways apart from the fact that Carney did actually manage it?
Yeah, our amazing producers have put something really interesting in front of me that I hadn't seen. So I was reading when we were coming on air. And that suggests that young voters actually flocked to the Canadians' conservatives. And there seems to be a bit of a swap between what you might think is a traditional voter patterns in Canada. So those aged over 60 were essentially what's being quoted by pollster David Coletto, the component of the Liberal success. And 18 to 34-year-olds actually went to the Conservatives. So support for the Conservatives outpaced the Liberals by 44% to 31% among 18 to 34-year-olds.
I have a theory about this.
Yeah, give it to me, because I can't understand it.
No, so I, and you know, it is literally just a kind of theory I've just literally thought up in my head just now. So yeah, you'll probably unpick it within seconds. But it seems to me that, weirdly, this election was won for Carney, who is the more kind of progressive, liberal force, on nationalism.
It was.
That Trump was threatening the sovereignty of Canada. And I think nationalism is something that tends to appeal a little bit more to older voters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, therefore, what we saw here was older voters choosing that kind of nationalist sentiment and therefore flocking to the Liberals.
Yeah,
whereas young people, who I think tend to feel a bit less tethered to the idea of kind of protecting or fighting for their country, but more tethered to their kind of individual material circumstances, mm-hmm. are more taken with the argument that Trump and those on the right make, which is about their economic well-being, suffering at the hands of immigrants or whatever it is. And therefore, it's an interesting shift. And it actually might have some interesting implications for Labour, which is like, is it time for the left to try and regain a bit of nationalist sentiment on their own terms?
Yeah, I mean, I could go into that for days. I had a proper argument and fight once upon a time in a meeting in a caucus of the left where I got essentially shunned out because I made the point that we cannot cede all patriotism and the flag to the right. We can't cede all of it. I understand that there are limits. But what's interesting about what I'm seeing in front of me is actually supports your point. Abacus data polling suggested that 18% of 18 to 29-year-olds were worried about Trump, and that jumped to 45% for voters over 60. So it seems like that younger voters voted particularly on domestic issues. So one of them in this BBC piece, Connor from Toronto, said he was drawn to the Conservatives because of housing and the cost of living. Another one talked about the economy and the fact that she didn't want her full name used, but economic growth in Canada had stagnated. Yeah. And so what's interesting is I think you're right. Over 60s voted on Trump and nationalism, and 18 to 36-year-olds voted on the domestic issues. And obviously, 11 years in government for any party is bound to see people want to see a shift. And that's where Mark Carney's success, I think, is particularly impressive. Not just that he won when polling suggested just a year ago that they were going to lose, but he won after 11 years in government by the Liberals.
Okay, that is very interesting. We'll keep an eye on that. And, of course, the relations between Canada and the US as Mark Carney settles into his role as Prime Minister. Coming up, is violence against MPs becoming more normalised after footage has emerged of Irish band Kneecap calling for people to kill their local MP? We'll be discussing whether threats against politicians are on the rise. All that and more next.
FUPAR Radio.
What the Hell with Georges Bertineau on FUBAR Radio.
I'm joined by Alex Mitten, retreat host and mentor.
I think a lot of people are lonely, surrounded by people at the minute. Like, you know, especially living in London, there's fucking people everywhere. But we sort of live these quite strange lives now where we're quite closed down emotionally, you know, even just like with our voice. We don't really speak that often sometimes, do you know what I mean?
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google app stores.
Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
I was fine on this beach the other day. I didn't know the time of high tide changes, and I had no idea it could come in so fast. So I'm finding out the hard way. From this fella, the Coast Guard, who dropped in to get me out.
Ready!
Before you go to the coast, check the tide times online. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search, don't get caught out.
Couple Goals with Sophie Kasai and Jordan Brooke.
When is too early to say I love you? Soph said it the night we met.
Yeah. I did. Right, okay, right, let's just clear this up, right? When I said I love you, I remember I said it in the car.
In the cab, yeah.
In the cab, and I was like, oh my God, I love you.
Yeah, that was the day I made you my girlfriend, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I said I love you, and you were like, I love you too, and I was like, I love you, 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 I love you so much, I love you so much, oh my God, I love you.
Death, a funny business on FUBAR Radio with Becky Briggs and Natasha Spencer-Levy.
We store so much of our trauma and our energy in our body. I am just incredibly, incredibly tired of keeping this trauma locked inside my body. And so all I needed to do is release it. You know, it's like going on a bender and drinking too much booze and you throw it up because you just need to get that out of your system because it's gonna catch up with you at some point if you don't.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald. Okay, Irish band Kneecap has been under fire this week after a video emerged of one of their gigs back in 2023, where the trio called for the crowd to kill your local MP and proclaimed the only good Tory is a dead Tory. The band stated the video was part of a coordinated smear campaign after their controversial appearance at Coachella and apologised to the families of murdered MPs Sir David Amos and Joe Cox. Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch has called for the trio to be prosecuted over these comments. But has inciting violence against politicians become more normalised? And what repercussions could this have for the safety of MPs? Ali, do you think we are seeing an increase in violent language towards politicians? And what do you think this means for democracy?
I think we're seeing an increase in normalisation of political violence as a whole. And I think Southport... Everything, and that's not just in the UK, but I think that's across the West. The insurrection January 6th in America, the Southport riots that took place in the UK here, I think there is an increase in extremism in political ideology, particularly and most fervently on the right. And I think, obviously, MPs are at the forefront of the risk relating to that. So what I worry about is that these dark sort of corners of the internet where conspiracy theories and far-right ideologies kind of fester and then manifest themselves in political violence is becoming more and more normal. What I will say is I think some, obviously nowhere near the majority, but there are some MPs who have contributed to turning up the heat in our political dialogue. And there seems to be this thing of when Joe Cox was murdered, when Sir David Amos was murdered, when there's instances of political violence, everybody comes to the House and says, we need to lower the volume, we need to be careful in our rhetoric, we need to be careful in our conversations for 2 or 3 weeks, and then they forget about it, and then political expediency takes over, and then all of a sudden they're using all of these extreme tropes, these far-right conspiracy theories, this ideology, this ideology that is very close to political violence and incites often hate crime, both violent and non-violent, particularly towards minorities. And I think all of that has contributed to a culture now where in our politics, political violence somehow is more normal than it used to be.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think... I feel that it is really important that we try and dial down some of the violent rhetoric that people use against politicians. I am certainly not a fan of the Conservatives, but we've seen the real life impact of this. You know, Sir David Amos was obviously murdered in his constituency, as was Joe Cox. And they were by two political... they were two sort of political murders on different ends of the spectrum in that, you know, they were ideologically separate, ideologically different from each other, but still, you know, incredibly violent and had such a horrific effect on British politics and the safety of MPs. And, you know, you speak to MPs and particularly female MPs, minority MPs, really fear violence against them. And there's actually a great show on Netflix called The Walk-In with Stephen Graham, which is... a dramatisation of the plot to kill the MP Rosie Cooper by a far-right group.
Oh, right, yeah.
So, you know, it is a real issue. It it really does worry MPs, and I think it's important that we take that seriously. Mm. What frustrates me a little bit about this is that Kemi Badenoch would call for the prosecution of these comments, but do we remember what the Tory donor who's given the largest single donation to the Conservative Party, Frank Hester, allegedly said about Diane Abbott?
Yeah.
And Kemi Badenoch's response was to call it trivia.
Yeah.
So which is it? You know, he said Diane Abbott made him want to shoot. What was it? All black
something
women?
Like that. Yeah. Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. It made him hate all black women.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, you have to be consistent with this view. I'm consistent with this view. Anyone on any side of the debate, whether it be someone on the left, whether it be someone on the right, there should be no tolerance for violent threats against anybody. But I think we need to be especially hot on violent threats against MPs because it is a real thing that they deal with.
Yeah, but it's because our politics has become so utterly tribal that no matter what my side says, I have to defend. Mm. And no matter what the other side says, I have to attack. And so Kemi Badenoch, obviously, because politics is so factional, so tribal, it's a football team, you wear red, I wear blue, we throw things at each other, that when her own lot, how one of her main donors says something, she calls it, I think, trivial, you said. And then, obviously, on this, she wants to see prosecutions. I also think our political system just isn't sort of equipped to deal with this level of violence. I remember when I was standing for MP, the night before my big rally, I got a death threat through the door. It was written on a little slit of paper, and there was no stamp and no address on it. So someone had walked up to my door and dropped a death threat. So
to your house?
To my house, to my constituency. I lived in the constituency. Mm. They dropped it to my house, and I sort of read it and laughed it off. But when I showed it to some people on the campaign immediately, they got really concerned. So they said, listen, you have to call the Labour Party and you have to report this because we've got this big rally tomorrow. And if someone shows up with a knife and wants to kill you, as it says on the note, there's nothing really that we're prepared for. There's no security system, anything like that. So I called the Labour Party and I told them that I'd received this death threat. And the response I got is, what do you want us to do?
Yeah.
What can we do? What do you want us to do? So I'm not blaming the Labour Party for this per se. I mean, I do blame them, but I don't think any of our political parties have dealt with this.
They're not
equipped to deal with it because this hasn't been normal in our politics. In the end, we ended up calling the police and the police came. But I don't think this is normal. Whereas, like, American politics is more securitized, if that makes sense. Mm. Politicians have more security, rallies have more security, political events have more security. We've not been used to that, and that's a good thing because it means constituents are closer to their representatives. Mm. It means they can just go up and have a chat with someone on a Friday at one of their surgeries. But I also think that with the rise of death threats and the amount that people get on social media, I don't think the system's just caught up with it yet.
No, and I agree. And I think, you know, there was a real conversation going on with the Speaker of the House, Sir Lindsay Hoyle, about MP security, you know, in the wake of the murders of David Amos and Joe Cox. And it was really difficult because he's, you know, yes, Parliament is responsible for keeping MPs safe on site, and they do. You know, I literally went through parliamentary security yesterday, and it is like airport security. Mm-hmm. They confiscated my microphone off me, my huge podcast microphone, because
did you get it back?
Yeah, I did, but I was very annoyed because they were like, "You're not allowed to take recording devices in," and I was like, "It's not a surreptitious recording device; it's a massive microphone that I have to plug into a laptop." Anyway, but my point is, they are very thorough. Yeah. But when they go back to their constituencies, what can Parliament do? It cannot, doesn't really have the funds to send private security out to everyone's constituency.
No.
So I think MPs feel really scared.
Yeah, I think Cabinet members get it, don't they?
Yes,
I'm sure
they do.
I think they do, yeah. I think imagine the cost of giving every MP security around the clock. Yeah. That would be through the roof.
Yeah.
But there is something to be said about the heat of the debate and how much that's been normalised, I think. And why we seem to constantly forget, and we get reminders at moments of violence when things like what happened to Joe Cox and Sir David Amos happens. But then this continuous spike in rhetoric. For example, we talk about MP safety, but why not talk about the impact MPs' words have on the country's safety?
Mm.
So Boris Johnson's comments around Muslim women, we know, saw a correlation. A correlation doesn't automatically equal causation, but between his comments about Muslim women and the spike in hate crimes towards Muslims and Islamophobia in this country, saw a massive spike.
Yeah.
We've seen the spike in Islamophobia and anti-Semitism since Gaza and October 7th has happened.
And arguably since Suella Braverman made the comments about illegal immigration being an invasion in the House of Commons.
Yeah, and the way that they talk about the Palestinian protests being hate marches and all this kind of, these things will play into the minds of extremists and those who are who think or thinking of political violence, and then impacts constituents. So I think, you know, we ought to, as well as obviously taking the threats against politicians very seriously, we ought to also have a conversation around the words politicians use having an impact on hate crime in the country.
I totally agree. I mean, the band is being investigated by counter-terrorism police. Mm-hmm. Because they also have said to have shouted in a video that emerged, I believe, from one of their gigs, up Hamas, up Hezbollah. I mean, again, this question of kind of freedom of speech versus inciting political violence versus, you know, seemingly supporting prescribed terrorist groups. I mean, what do you think if you know, if Keir Starmer or the Prime Minister's spokesperson is asked about this? I mean, what do you think Labour's response should be on this?
I have to be really honest, I haven't seen it. So I'm this isn't a cop out, but I actually haven't seen the video because they've said it's been taken out of context. I am obviously really, really hesitant for the political system to intervene in the arts and say who isn't allowed to perform. Now, obviously, the accusation here is a breach of the law.
Yeah.
Right. So that'll be investigated by the police, because there are very clear guidelines on when free speech becomes hate speech and when you breach the law. Unless you've breached the law, I'm not comfortable with any politician of any stripe telling artists where they can and cannot perform. I think that's a really dangerous road to go down. What I want to ask you about, really interestingly, is the fact that our political discussion has shifted from the physical space to the online space is one area I don't think we've discussed. So, for example, this might be controversial. We've only got 3 minutes left. But so a lot of the hate, these death threats that people say they get, I don't actually believe. It's just online.
Yeah,
like, it's
keyboard warriors.
It's probably some Russian.
Because
like,
someone can send it directly to you without having to do any research about where you live or who you are.
Me and you, I think when you were on Twitter, and certainly me, because for some reason I'm still suffering through Twitter, get death threats all the time, right? Or not death threats, but threats all the time underneath you. They're not real, are they? Like, but the problem is all you need is one to be real. But I think we are over-egging a little bit the amount of threats coming in, because a lot of them are probably orchestrated by nefarious states who are seeking to sow division.
Trolls who are, you know, just trying to know they'll never be tracked and feel like they can say anything
they want. It's a video. You wouldn't have seen it because it's not on Twitter. But there's a video of a fella, I think he's like some super right-wing, typing in all caps this really horrific stuff underneath Rupert Lowe's tweets about like deporting all immigrants or something. And someone videoed him in the local library in East London as he's typing away.
Really?
And he's this old, this big old guy who's clearly just like, and he's typing away and someone's filmed him. And then they found the tweet that he tweeted, because it was an anonymous account. So obviously the internet did its thing and found him. And and everyone underneath it has tweeted the video of him.
That's excellent. And
it's an interesting insight into what this guy thinks. He's got total anonymity, but he's gone to his local library. Probably, by the way, because he can't afford internet, because the fucking conservatives have fucked the economy so much. And our economy is in such a state where, compared to Japan and other major global economies, a lot of our country still doesn't have access to the internet. He's gone to his local library and tweeted this really horrific tweet around deporting all immigrants, thinking he's got total anonymity, and someone has videotaped him. And I'll send it to you. I don't know if you'll be able to see it, but I'll send it to you.
No, well, so there you go. I mean, that is extraordinary. And I think, you know, it'll be interesting to see whether we can have a more measured conversation about the violence that people put out online. You know, we still have people on GB News saying, that Keir Starmer locked up a load of people just but for saying nasty things during civil rights. When they didn't, they were inciting violence and hate.
That's the thing. You cannot wash your hands when moments of violence spike, be it that to MPs, to minorities, or to just a white British man, for example, right? If political violence manifests, you can't then wash your hands of everything that led up to that, big or small. So that's whether you went on GB News and you spread what you know to be false accusations of two-tier Keir and a Labour Party that's locking people up for just thinking things, for example, all the way to others who might say kill your Tory MPs, which I'm not saying that's what Kneecap says because I haven't seen it. But you can't completely wash your hands of it.
No, you have to be consistent.
Right, that's it from Politics Uncensored today. Join us next Thursday at 5 p.m. where we unwrap the week's political talking points. You can stay up to date with the show by following at Politics Uncensored UK on social media, where you can find me at Ali Milani UK.
And you can find me at Zoe Grunewald.
If you've missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up at FooBarRadio.com or via the FooBar Radio app.
Download it from your app store now.
Thanks for listening. See you next week for another episode of Politics Uncensored.